Welcome back to Use Your Illusion 2 of my conversation with Rama Valluri. Let's get to it.
And this was the thing. I don't know if I've ever told him. I probably have. Josh Callahan is a really good friend.
Amazing.
And when I got to Second City and I walked in, he was in four different premium shows at once. And I just went, what is it about Josh that he is that guy? Like, I want to do that.
Yeah.
And then I looked around one day and I was that guy. And I went, I got to go. I got to leave. Somebody else needs this spot and it isn't me.
That's
and
right.
Particularly being a minority, I went, well, if I have this spot, that means another minority doesn't, because we
that's
only
right.
get one of us in a show at any given time.
Jeez.
So I left.
Yeah.
But I really thought about that and I went, okay, well, I guess I'm a comedian now, especially working with Sean. And we went, okay, we have our thing. We can write. We do all this. Yeah. I am a comedian. Then I got my agents. Really, it's the strangest thing. My then roommate, one of my best friends, he was working at the Tennis Channel with another guy who was also a comedy writer, and he and his writing partner were filming their pilot, self-producing it, and they couldn't find someone to play a homeless man from Gaza, which was a physical comedy bit. They couldn't find someone who they liked the look of or they thought could work, and they went through all the central casting things and it just didn't work out. And he said, you should talk to my roommate, he's at Second City. And I get this call going, hey, do you have your headshot and resume? I was like, no, I'm in Amoeba Records in the blues section right now looking at BB King Records. Why? And he told me, oh, it's for this thing, it's for this pilot my friend Heath is working on. I think you'd be perfect for it. I'm like, well, I'm going to this Adams for Peace concert right after. It's like the most Amoeba Records crate digger story you could have. It's like, yeah, I was looking for BB King Records and I was going to go see Tom York's side project at the Hollywood Bowl. So I took a picture of myself looking as miserable as I could, and my hair was long and I had a goatee. Uh-huh. And I just sent that and they went, yeah,
perfect.
Yeah, he should do it. And I went, great, I'll go do this pilot, whatever it is. And I show up, and when they gave me some things like, oh, he lived in Gaza, he's like North African, and they went right away, you look like the most South Indian guy we've ever seen in our lives, so no one's going to buy it, but it's a pilot, so we should be okay. And so while I was living in Paris, I was listening to all this music from Libya and Algeria and all from the immigrant community that I lived around in the 19th, in the 19th arrondissement. Oh, wow. And there was this one song by Rashid Taha called Ya Raya, which is this traditional folk song in Arabic. And I loved it. So I started memorizing lyrics from that. And then the Panda Cheese Company in Egypt had these hilarious commercials of someone in a full body panda costume. And they would ask, like, oh, we should get some panda cheese. And someone always said, no. And the moment they say no, this panda just appears and is staring at them. And a Buddy Holly song going, just you know why, starts singing. And then the panda just destroys everything. And it ends with the song. He's like, panda, naitaleshla. Like, don't mess with the panda. So I memorized that stuff and I went. And right when I got there, one of the guys working on it went, are you union? I went, no. And as a voice actor, all I was thinking was, this is the hardest thing for us, is how do you become union if you're a voice actor?
Yeah.
And he went, well, I know it seems like a small part on the page, but it actually is a pretty, pretty big one. So we're going to Taft-Hartley you in. You're going to be union eligible. I went, great.
Yeah.
Like, being in this back alley in Santa Monica behind a gas station, who would have thought?
Right.
And I was looking, they gave me the wardrobe, and I looked at it and went, I don't feel like I've lived on the street long enough to really sell this. So I was just in the back alley and I picked up clumps of dirt of unknown providence. Probably a bunch of dogs and cats had gone on it.
Right.
People too. Rubbed it all over the clothes, rubbed it in my hair and the goatee. They gave me these flip-flops and I looked down at them and went, these are too nice. Clearly they're new. So I took a piece of broken glass I found and I cut the sandals open. So
oh
the thong
God.
Part slipped off. So you'd have to hook your big toe around the pin to keep them together, and then was duck walking like Chuck Berry or Charlie Chaplin while pushing a shopping cart going, this feels real. And the other writer of the pilot, his name's Spencer Willis, and he and I became friends off of that. And then he wrote another part for me in another pilot he and Heath wrote. And then off of a show at Second City, which was confidentially my least favorite show because I dealt with a lot of racist stuff directly related to it.
Judas Priest.
And at the industry night, all the reps were there, and I had gotten some meetings off of it. And one agent was in her office, and she held up headshots of the people from the show that she wanted to meet. She holds up mine. The guy at the other side of the table goes, "That guy? You want to meet that guy? What do you want to meet that guy for?" She goes, "Why? I like him. He was funny, and he can sing." And he goes, "I'm just kidding. I know him. He's a friend of mine. I could get him here tomorrow." And that was Spencer Willis, who wrote those.
Oh, my God.
Files. He took a desk again because he and his wife had a kid, and he had worked at Buchwald.
Uh-huh.
And then he was doing management and writing these pilots, and he's a hilarious guy. And he just went, "Yeah, I was just sitting there." She held up. And he's telling me the story. I'm sitting at my job, and I'm so clueless. He's like, "Oh, hey, Spencer, how's it going?" And he's like, "Good, good. I don't know if you saw, but I took a desk over at Stewart." And went, "Ah, because of the baby. Congratulations again on the baby. How's that going?" I just keep derailing his story, asking about him personally. So then he's telling me this story, which I think is just really funny. I think he's going to say, "Oh, let's go get a drink," or "I got this other thing that I
right.
need to appear in." And then he goes to that part of, "That guy? You want to meet that guy?" And he goes, "And it was you. She was holding up your headshot." I went, "Oh, how about that?" He goes, "So I guess what I'm asking is, what are you doing at 3 o'clock tomorrow?" I went, "Clearly I'm ducking work to go meet you wherever." And I walk in, and Susan Zachary looks at me and she goes, "I don't know you. I've never met you. I just know I saw you at a show at Second City, and I thought you're talented and really funny, and I wanted to meet you. This guy won't stop talking about you. So let's get to know you." Like, okay.
Amazing.
And because Spencer was sitting there, I went, "Look, I had this approach once I got to this point going, I never had rep. No one was really entertaining it except for those folks where you read the horror stories about right away."
Yeah,
one
right.
Guy saying, "Do you have any headshots where you're dressed like an Indian prince or riding an elephant? Could you give me Priyanka Chopra's number?"
Oh,
that guy
was
my favorite.
Oh,
so I went, "Look, I don't know that I'll ever be in this position again. I'm not going to try too hard. I'm just going to be me, and then I can have the self-satisfaction of knowing that I cheated the system and wasn't at work." And they can't make you an offer in the room, so we met. And they went, "How many more meetings do you have?" And I told him, I was like, "Look, I got 8, and most of them were commercial agents." And I went, "Well, I'm going to take them all because you never know when you're ever going to be in the position again." And they went, 9. I went, "What's 9? I went, "Our commercial guy, Mark Park, wants to meet with you." I went, "Okay." And Spencer just leans over to me and says, "I feel bad for any of the agencies that follows because you're going to like him." I went, "Am I now?" He goes, "Look, I know you're not someone who likes agents or suits, but he's a real person. A genuine person, and I'm just telling you, he's going to make it real hard for you to want to go anywhere else." And I went, "All right." And I met with him, and I love this guy. I'm still with both of them.
Amazing.
And they looked at me right when I walked in. Spencer went, "Admittedly, you're a project. You are this comedian, and you can do all of these things. You're a physical comedian. You can play the guitar. You can sing. You can be in musicals. But you skipped a lot of steps." I went, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, you didn't go to an acting school. You haven't taken a bunch of acting classes. You're just this guy who can do all of this stuff. And there are people who you'll be auditioning against who have all that acting background but cannot do all the other things that you do."
Yes.
"So I'm saying this is a very achievable thing, but it will take us some time." And they've been extraordinarily patient with me.
Wow.
Along the way, where they know at any point they could say, "Hey, you need to go take a class. I think it's time. You got to go back and take a class." And I said, "Okay, where do you want me to go?"
Yeah.
And they told me to go to Margie Haber, and I did.
Uh-huh.
And Robin Myers, I love her. She has helped me so much. I'm so much better for having gone there.
Amazing.
But that was the whole thing. It's like, I was fortunate that I got that. I said yes to being in a pilot for some guy I didn't know.
Yeah.
And that I just showed up to be a professional. And they thought what we were doing, myself and this other actor, was so funny for this bit part that they didn't call cut. They were like biting their knuckles because it was too funny. They didn't want to ruin it.
That's awesome.
And I was like, I came to play. And because I came to play, but I was prepared, they wanted to work with me again. And then they remembered it later. And I've basically been trying to reward that trust ever since. So he can call me and say, "You did a really bad job on this audition. You need to do it again." And part of me will go, "Ah, dang it." And in the back of my head, I'll go, "There it is again. I don't want to let him down. So I got to really, really prepare this." And he'll always say, he's like, "Look, I'm never mad at you. I just point out that this is, maybe you read it wrong or your take was wrong because I'm helping you. It's like, I know, but I'm just, I'm tired of disappointing you because I make money for all these other people. And when right. When I got to WME and I booked everything except for animation,
oh man,
I was like, that's the last piece. That's the only thing I've ever wanted to do.
Yeah.
How am I going to cross that one? And they would keep telling me, don't worry, you're right there.
Yeah.
It's a hair's breadth away. You're going to get one of them. Like, oh, you keep saying that.
Right.
But clearly there's something I got to do better that I don't know about. And
right.
I started looking to see, is Charlie Adler teaching? Should I go talk to Bill Farmer? I don't know who else might be around.
Right.
Anybody. Right. Like, who right. happens to be teaching? Should I go there? And then they did us that favor of deciding to close the voiceover department.
Oh, like, that's right. That's what happened. Oh, my God.
That was a very interesting experience because I went, it's when you get there, you meet all these people who've been rep for 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
And they haven't had any reason to leave. And I went, great. I'm never going to have to do what I did when I started out, which was, with the arrogance of youth, just cold submit to everybody.
Yeah.
Saying, yeah, I worked with Nancy. I was a radio guy. Here's my demo. Isn't it great? I think I would be an asset. Here are the things I can do. Most of them wouldn't respond. Some of them were kind enough to tell me that they loved my voice, but not till I was union. That was the thing with WME, actually. I danced around them for 7 years before they actually took me.
Wow.
Where another Tennis Channel connection went, you should talk to Cody Irizarry. He's a friend of mine. You should be there. Well, yeah, I should be at WME. Why shouldn't I be at WME 1 year into this gig? And I got in touch with him via email, and he had no reason to respond to me other than he knew the other guy who I referenced. But he took the time, he listened to the demo, and he said, love your voice. I love your delivery, but it is too soon for you to be at WME.
Hmm.
Definitely get back in touch with me when you're union. I went, okay. A year and a half, 2 years later, I'm union now because I'd gotten that. I was must join. I joined and went. The day that I joined and paid them that king's ransom.
Yes.
I
3,000.
Went, hey, so remember how you said when I was union to get back in touch with you? Well, I'm union. And here are the other things that I've booked since.
Yeah.
Same kind of response. Congratulations on being union. Still love your voice, still love your delivery, but it is still too soon. Cut your teeth a little bit longer at some of the boutiques. So I continued just pounding the pavement. Every time I would book something new, I would find a different agency to get in contact with. I was with ADM and Shane Cormier for a bit.
Uh-huh.
And then I said after that second time WME said no, and it wasn't like flat out no, never. It was
yeah.
not yet.
Yes.
When, in my head, I went, the next time I talk to them, they're going to be asking me
yeah.
to come. And I got to figure out how to do that. And on the strangest of circumstances, my 30th birthday was one of the worst on record because I had blown out my left knee. And I had blown out my right knee twice. And finally, my left knee went out. It got wrenched leaving the Staples Center.
Oh,
and
no.
a pothole on Figueroa that you don't see because there's a massive people.
Yeah, yeah. You can't
first
see anything.
First time I had gotten to see a Laker game because I'd been seeing Clippers games the whole time. And some friends who were from Memphis went, we want to see the Grizz versus the Lakers. Kobe wasn't even playing.
Yeah.
So, and the girl who had the ticket showed up at halftime. So we were already
oh my God.
Just annoyed by everything and just get pushed by this mass of humanity. My foot goes into a pothole. My knee wrenches.
Oh.
And I think, oh, I just tweaked it. It was WrestleMania that year, I remember, because I was driving over to a friend's place to watch that. As the drive got longer and I got out, my left leg started pulling further and further in.
Oh, my God.
To the point that when I was going in, it was almost folded up.
Oh.
And I knew something was wrong, and I limped my way through work the next day until I could get an appointment with my doctor, who was out of town. So for like 10 days, I'm limping around.
Oh, my God.
And I know it's bad. And then they thought I had either broke my knee. So they sent me for, like, shatter my patella or something, or I'd torn everything. So they sent me for a battery of tests, and it turned out nothing was broken, and they couldn't see evidence of any tears. So they sent me to a physical therapist. Somehow my hamstring got knotted around my knee.
Oh.
So there was just this huge knot there, and the only way to release it, unless you went in and did surgery, which would be dangerous,
yeah.
was you had to massage it out by constant physical therapy. And this being the third time that I had a traumatic, significant knee injury, I was like, no, I'm going to go 4 days. I'm going to do whatever. I got to get out of this because I couldn't go to work, which I was fine with. I could work from home. I didn't care about the work thing. But I couldn't be a part of anything at Second City anymore.
Oh, yeah.
Every show that I was a part of, I had to leave. And
my
friend Eric Phillips, who writes on the Apple show For All Mankind now, he had this really smart musical called Fox News the Musical.
Uh-huh.
And he had a part that he wrote with me in mind. And because he's such a great guy, he tailored the rehearsal schedule around my availability.
Oh, my God.
Because he knew I'm too busy doing everything else, and he just really wanted me in it. And it aggravated. Because before I could go to the doctor, I was at a rehearsal for that, and I was telling the choreographer, I can't do this. I cannot do this. Can we simplify it? And she kept saying, oh, no, you're fine, you're fine, you're fine. I heard a pop, and it went really bad. So the week the show was supposed to open, I had to call him and say, I can't walk. I've been told I can't drive. This is going to be 5 months.
Oh, my God,
I
dude.
I had never felt as helpless as I did then, because before, when my knee went out, I was in high school, so I was at home.
Yeah.
And that's okay. And my parents are doctors. And then I was in college. I was only 2.5 hours away. It's okay. I learned how to run on crutches and climb 5 flights of stairs in Greg Hall, which didn't have a good elevator. Like, I could do that. But here, I'm in L.A.
Yeah.
It's a sprawl. You got to drive everywhere.
Yeah.
And even if it's your non-dominant leg, I'm not controlling pedals with this foot.
Still.
That position was so awful. And they were like, you cannot do anything. You can't. You have to sit in your house. On a couch, laying in bed, icing it this often, do these stretches, then you come back to us. So I got out of work, and then I had to quit every show that I was a part of.
Oh, my
and
God.
Right away, like, that depression kicked in because I was defining my usefulness or my worth. My personal worth was assigned directly to how useful I was to everybody else.
Mm.
Like, what shows I could do, what things I was a part of, what was the next thing that could get me out of that job. And that was the kind of thing that professor reminded me of in Syracuse. He's like, the biggest thing you have to do is be present in this moment, not 2 years from now, or what is the thing that is going to get me to that next thing.
Yeah.
And my brothers were oddly excited when I called them and I said, I'm just going to, you know, let this be bad. And they went, what? I went, well, so I can't walk. I had to quit every show. The people, some of the friends of mine from Second City just haven't even checked on me once because I'm not around. I'm not available to be a crowd member at their show.
Hmm.
I can't do a bit at their show. I can't help them out. So I don't really matter in a way to them in this utilitarian relationship, which was great because it clarified so many of my relationships.
Yeah.
And as a bonus, a girl I was seeing at the time turned out I was the other guy. And she hadn't told me. So all of this collided at once as I turned 30. And yeah, it was so strange. And I really sat with it because it was right after my niece was born. So I had to run through LAX in 2 knee braces like Stone Cold Steve Austin, and they were stopping me. And it was while I was there, I got this message from that girl going like, oh, I don't think I'm in a position to see anybody right now, but we should keep seeing each other. And then I saw the picture of her and the other guy. I went,
oh God,
I was the other guy. This is terrible. So I get back and I can't do shows. I can't work. I can't do anything. I can't even walk around, like going to a grocery store or Home Depot were the two things I could do. So I figured I was in the apartment. I was going to fix all these things.
Right.
And I had 20 minutes of physical stamina in me that I could really be up on my feet and go through grocery stores or the hardware stores. And I was just sitting there going, I'm on painkillers and I hate them. Because if anybody who has ever had to really take them for a reason loathes the idea of them.
Hmm.
The pain that it's numbing has all sorts of other side effects. If you can't eat, you can't sleep, you're nauseous, you feel like you're hollow.
Yeah.
There's all these terrible things with it. So I'm avoiding taking them until I absolutely have to.
Yeah.
But I'm by myself all day until my roommates show up. I'm bored. I don't want to eat. This was bad news. I can't do these shows. These people aren't talking to me. I was just really looking at it going, what the hell did I waste all these years on? I'm no further in what I'm doing. I'm just phoning it in. And when I called them and told them, I was like, yeah, you know, I'm just going to actually let this happen. And they went, what? I'm not going to run from it. I can't hide behind work because I can't do any work.
Yeah.
So I guess got to sit with this and face it and process it and let it be bad. Wow. There's no real silver lining to this situation. It's I got to let it feel bad and I got to feel every emotion of this.
Yeah.
And my brother, 2 years older than me, goes, wow, I've been waiting for this phone call for so long.
Wow.
Where he and my oldest brother had talked about this going, yeah, all of these terrible things can happen and he'll compartmentalize and just work through it.
Hmm.
And not let it be bad. It's like they would look at things that I was dealing with and go, "This is really bad." Yeah, it's not. No, this is just how it's. This is how it is here. You just gotta put your head down and work through it. So they looked at it as this is, and my sister-in-law too was like, "This is the most healthy response that we've ever heard from you."
Wow.
I went, "Yeah, it really is, and things do suck, but." The clarity of who actually came by, like people who decided to drive all the way across town or were just checking on me on a daily basis, not asking like, how's your knee?
Right.
They would send me goofy videos or say, hey, you should watch this. Aaron Tokey came over and introduced me to One Punch Man, the hoodie that I'm wearing right now. He just went, bro, you're going to love this. It's an anime. It's like, I don't really watch him. He's like, no.
Gotta
You're
watch
gonna
this.
Like it.
Gotta watch this one.
He can defeat any monster with one punch. I'm like, what? That doesn't make any sense. How is there a show that's over in an episode? He goes, trust me.
Yeah.
You gotta see this. So we started watching it, and I went, this is such a strange thing. Aaron just had an afternoon. He went, I'm gonna drive from Hollywood to Culver City to sit with you and introduce you to One Punch Man.
Amazing.
And he just brought a stack of comic books saying, I think you need to read these. So he just said, oh, yeah, this is bad, but I've got a good way for you to spend this time.
Yeah.
And so I was like, okay, you know, it's not so bad. But yeah. I remember when I was able to walk again and I got back to Second City, right away, someone came up to me and went, hey, where were you? I went, what? Like, where have you been? I haven't seen you for like the whole year. I went, I couldn't walk. Everybody knew I couldn't walk. He went, oh, but you can walk now? I went, yeah. He goes, want to come to my show at 11 at the clubhouse? I went, no.
Yeah.
No. Thank you, though. Thank you. And the call that I got that really got me back into thinking, okay, this I'm ready to play again was from Ron West. And I love this man so much.
Amen.
He just goes, hey, can you walk? Yes, Ron, I can walk. Goes, good. I'm doing a new musical with the Open Fist. It's something that I wrote with Phil back in Chicago. It's called Delirious. It's about King Lear, but it's very Monty Python Mel Brooks. Can you walk? Right, yes. Can you dance? Yes. Goes, can you be at the theater in Atwater Village at 1 o'clock on Friday? I was like, I will be. And you have to fill out the forms like, oh, this is the part that I'm thinking of and all that. I wrote whatever Ron wants.
Yes, that's how you do it.
If there's a truth to working with Ron, there are the people from the legit theater world who he works with, from the Open Fist or his project, Capula Company or anything, these seasoned theater performers.
Derek Manson. And
who he knows. And then there are people like me or George Kaliotis.
Yeah. Or me.
Or you. Where he and Catherine go, well, you should bring them.
Yeah.
And Ron will always go, what are you doing? Can you come and do this? It's like, I can't pay you, but I think it'll be worth it.
Yeah.
And all I could think of was, well, if I'm going to do a show, I'd like to work with Ron because that man taught me more about being a professional in this than anybody else. It's like, know your lines, know your entrances, know your props, and if you get a note, take the note.
Take the note.
There's a reason he's giving the note.
That's right.
Take the note. And so I walk in, and he goes, oh, good, you can walk. And I can do this, too. And I jumped up and clicked my heels like Ron Santo, because this was around that. Like, I was feeling good. And I did the thing, and he left. And he goes, okay, so you're going to be this part in it. And he had me being the Duke of Albany in King Lear, who is a cuckold.
Uh-huh.
And he also made me the Reverend Lancelot Andrews, the man who led the writing of the King James Bible.
Amazing.
And he went, you get to be two completely different people in here, so I need to see what you're going to do that's completely different. So I played one, the Duke of Albany, as a completely clueless guy, knowing that I was going to be a cuckold, wearing just the flashiest burgundy tuxedo that I had, which this is a fun thing for you. I wore that at the wedding of Natalie Delasio and Kevin
Stafford. Oh, my God. Yeah.
Which you were the officiant.
I was.
Natalie told me to buy that when I just posed it. I was like, should I get this blue tux or this burgundy tux? She goes, get the burgundy one. Get the burgundy one, and you have to wear it to my wedding. I went, all right. So I didn't think anything of it. And I wore it as a gift to her, and then I walk in, and Gina Ippolito walks up to me and goes, are you in the bridal party? I went, what? No. She goes, you're dressed like it. I went, no. And I look around, and everybody's wearing some combination of burgundy and black, and Natalie comes up to me just laughing, goes, I can't believe you actually did it. I love this so much.
Oh, my God.
So I was wearing that as that character, and then as the Lancelot Andrews, I decided I was just going to be Terry Thomas.
Oh, man, brilliant.
Most people don't know the reference.
Yes.
I'm like, well, great. Everything I'm saying is a bit of a con. We all know what we're here for. And I was wearing tweed. So every physical movement was so much grander as him. And everything just sort of went. And he just let me play. And I was having so much fun. Even though I would look around and when people would go, well, what shows did you do with Ron? I was like, oh, I'm a Second City guy. And they would say, like, oh, did you do Chorus Line or something? I was like, no. I'm a Second City guy.
Second City.
We do make-em-ups.
That's right.
And it was so much fun working with them because they were all just really talented performers and dancers and singers and all just kind, nice, funny people, which is the community that Ron fosters.
Yeah.
And Ron was in it, and he'd always turn to me and make these little cutting remarks of, you know, back in 1988, I was in Chicago, and Dave Thomas and I saw this man at this party. And then he would just go, tell me that, and turn around and go, okay, everyone, so we've got this. And while I was doing that show, Scott Mosenson was in the cast. He played Shakespeare and the Duke of Gloucester. And he's also a guy from Chicago, and he knew I was a Cubs fan. He goes, what are you doing on Thursday? When I'm watching the game and trying to memorize lines, he goes, come over to my house. A bunch of the guys are going to be over. We play poker, and we can run lines and watch the game. I went, well, I can't play poker because I don't have your money, but and that would start a whole new problem. But I'll watch the game, and I go over there, and we're running lines, and he turns to me and just goes, you do all these voices, you sing, you can do accents, and you do impressions. You're a voiceover guy, right? He's like, yeah. He goes, who's your rep? And I just started giggling. Oh, I outgrew them a long time ago. And he went, what do you mean? Went, they were great for where I was when I started, but now they don't have access to the kind of things that I should be doing.
Yeah.
And I know that I'm capable of doing.
Yeah.
So I know that we've hit the end of the road here, but I don't know where to go next. And he goes, do you have your demo? Like, yep. You have a resume? Yep. Send it to me. I'm going to send it to my guy. I'm like, who are you with? He goes, WME. I just started laughing. I went, wow. And he went, why? And I told him, like, I've been dancing around. And he goes, well, I've only referred 3 people in 20 years. And Eric Seastrand is a friend of mine. And he'll know it's serious when it's coming from me. I went,
wow.
All right. So I ducked out of work the next day, that morning, to shoot a promotional bit for Indian Wedding, a show that I was a part of. Uh-huh. And I get the call while I'm there from the assistant going, hey, could you come in on Monday? Eric and Cody would like to meet with you. And went, yeah, okay. Could we make it Wednesday, though? And he went, what? I went, well, I'm opening a musical this weekend, and there are 5 shows this weekend, and I want to make sure I have a voice when I come to see you.
He goes, amen.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely remind them that you're doing that when you get there, that you're in the show. Went, okay. So I go there, ducked out of work again, and it's Wilshire and Rodeo, and I have no business being on Wilshire and Rodeo. Nothing about me says Beverly Hills. I walk in and think, well, this may be the only time I'm here. And that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Like, let's just enjoy it for what it is. I'm thinking I'm going to this meeting. Someone walks up to me and hands me a stack of papers and says, yeah, one of the engineers will come to you in 10 minutes. I went, it's a cold read?
It's a potential.
Yeah, we just got to get an idea. I went, okay. Because the whole time Mosey had been priming me, oh, you're just going to go in there and talk to Eric, and he's from the Midwest, and Cody's from the Midwest. They're going to love you, and plus you got me. I went, all right. And then all of a sudden, I'm handed this stack of papers. I'm like, okay, well, what do we got here? And they probably still do this once the world opens up.
Yeah.
At the bigger agencies. The first thing was a network tease for Freeform, which I knew had previously been to ABC Family.
Yeah.
So I knew what kind of voice they were looking for, which is something bright like this.
Yeah.
The second was an ad for a trucking company, which is just one of those really slow, how trustworthy can your voice be?
Yeah.
We'll get you your things on time.
Yeah.
The third was sides from the new Rocky and Bullwinkle. And I, as being someone who loves to talk like Bullwinkle, I thought this was a great, great idea. My Rocky isn't as good. I can't get as high up there as
Rocky's
you
tough, man. No, here's something we hope you really like. I hear too much of myself in Rocky still. But...
Yeah, I hear myself purely in Bullwinkle. Hey, Rocky, want to see me pull a rabbit out of my hat?
Again?
Leave. Presto. Ooh. Don't think I know my own strength. So it's some side character, and I looked at it and went, I have three voices right away that I would want to do.
Yeah.
Because it could be three completely different people based on what they said.
That's right.
Go in the booth. We do the Freeform thing. And I look up, and the engineer's my now friend Corey. I went, how was that? And he goes, that was great for me. Went, okay. We do the second one. He goes, yeah, I'm good with that. I went, all right. Then we get to the Rocky and Bullwinkle thing. I got three voices for you. He goes, really? I went, yeah, we'll do all three, and then you take whatever one you think is best. We do all three. He kept all three because he liked them all. And then he and I just started joking around. So I went, here's my people. The man behind the plexiglass, the engineer, I have been you. We just start joking around, and I'm doing voices and running bits. And then I leave. Or I walk out, and he goes, who are you supposed to be meeting with? And I said, Cody and Eric. So he goes over and tells them. The assistant comes back and goes, thank you so much for coming in. We'll let you know in 10 days if you're a fit for the roster. I went, right on. Okay. I go back to work thinking, well, I did as much as I can do, and we'll see in 10 days.
That's right.
I got the call the next morning going, hey, they want to meet with you.
Amazing.
So that's one of those things of the amount of hours I put in and I didn't have to mark it up. I went, oh, I know what they're asking for. I know they want to hear, because they know what my age is. They're like, okay, we want to see, can you be that youthful voice that's friendly for TV for this thing? But also, how flexible are you? Can you sound appealing to a trucker in the Midwest? And how everyone wants to do animation, but can you do animation?
Right.
And those are two very different things.
Absolutely.
And when I walked in, we just started joking around when I got there for a good 40 minutes. And Eric goes, okay, look, before we get too much further, because we're having too much fun, we want you across the board. What do you say? And I went, before I answer, and he goes, oh, Jesus Christ. I went, I have to address the elephant in the room. And I turn to my right and go, you. And I pointed at Cody, and he just goes, me? Eric looks at him and goes, Cody, what the F did you do? He goes, I don't know. We're about to find out. I went, 7 years ago, I emailed you via this, and I tell him that story. And you turned me down. And Eric goes, what did you do? We could have had him 7 years ago. And I went, no, there's more. And then I became union. And you turned me down again. He goes, don't, no need to apologize. What I wanted to say was thank you. And they went, why? I went, without you taking the time, which you absolutely didn't have to do, you took the time, you read the message, you listened to it, and then you rejected me. But by rejecting me, you gave me the direct blueprint that I needed to get where I need to be.
Yeah.
And I said after that second time, you would be asking me. And now I find it very funny that here we are and you are asking me.
Wow.
And he just looks at Eric, and Eric is like shaking his head at him and goes, well, I wasn't wrong. We do love your voice and your delivery, and you're here. Went, no, it's all good. Also, I am repped on camera by these people. That's not going to be a problem. He goes, no, that's not going to be a problem. Don't worry. Went, okay, then we have an agreement. And when I told my on-camera folks, I had a meeting with WME, right away they went, what? Are you leaving? Went, no, don't worry. It's just for VO. And Spencer goes, uh-huh. Went, I'm not leaving you. They didn't even bring it up.
That's awesome.
Don't need someone like me down that hallway. You know I don't book anything. And he's just laughing because I had booked things. But he was like, part of him was going, okay, yeah, this is where you do need to be. He knew I was always going to do the voiceover stuff.
Yeah.
But it was such a complicated process because you go from, I'm a VO guy, I'm a radio guy, now they're telling me I have to get in the Screen Actors Guild. How do you do that as a VO person? You got to book something union.
Right.
Or you got to find another way. And going to the second city and just happening to be friends with this guy from grad school who I lived with, and him being in the right place got me to that one audition that I, or the one bit part that covered myself in dirt just to, just to do it better. And that led to the next one with them, which led them to take a chance on me when it, when it came to making me into a project and getting me to submit to Saturday Night Live years in a row and getting great feedback from New York. I'm like, great. Okay. Amazing. If I never even make it on the show, I know what I do. They like, and that they stuck by me this whole time. It's like, well, I'm making you money commercially. That's cool. Like, I'm on camera in these commercials and there's money coming in, but I'm not making you much on the theatrical side. Any day he calls me, he's going to say, well, buddy, it ran its course. And I was expecting that so much. And then I got tuned in on Nickelodeon.
Man, that's...
Which was the craziest thing. Like, I told you, I got ghosted on a national that ran during the Super Bowl, and I felt so low going, I don't know how I'm going to qualify for healthcare for the next year. I don't know how I'm going to pay this mortgage that I now have.
Yeah.
That would have covered it. And then, what, 3 days later, it's like, hey, there's this audition for you to be the host of a game show on Nickelodeon for kids. It's face-tracked, and it's voice work, and you can do whatever the heck you want. So technically it's on camera, but it's also a VO gig.
Yeah.
And they, like, my agent, when Spencer told me about it, because he called me after I submitted, he went, this is just the weirdest thing that came up that was so perfectly you.
Yeah.
It's everything you do. It's physical comedy. It's improv. It's Robin Williams vocal gymnastics.
Yeah.
It's hosting a game show, and it's for kids. And as a professional uncle.
Yes.
Very popular with my nieces and nephews, partly because I have a puppet of me that Sean made. I was like, great, I understand how to play
and you're so good on that show. It's so fun to watch you interact with those kids through this robot.
That was one thing too, when you were asking about what do you find with the voice, and they wanted something similar to my voice. And the crazy thing was, I did the tape and I sent it in, and I was expecting, oh, you did it wrong, you gotta do it again. And I didn't. The call I got was, hey, casting wants to talk to you. They want you to re-record because of one thing. And Tanya was the casting director, Tanya Jiang. She called and went, so I was watching your tape and I just loved your personality slate. That was where I was tired, and I just matter-of-factly talked about, this is like, I'm this guy, I was with WME for this time, I'm at Innovative for voiceover now, I was a radio guy, just talking about all of these things that I did.
Yeah.
That was what resonated with her, because when I did the bit, the sides on the next clip, I put on a robot voice, like a higher pitched thing that was more like this, and it was going really fast.
Yeah.
And what she loved was I was changing my voice at will and doing impressions of SpongeBob characters and everything, and I could do that without breaking a sweat.
Yeah.
And then you had to interview something, and I interviewed a puppet version of myself. And she said what I loved was, your personality is so great. You were so cool that when I saw the next clip, it felt like I was being let down a bit, because the voice that you were doing was more for 4 and 5 year olds than the 8 to 12. So
yeah,
could you just do it all again? Like, leave the personality slate, but do it again and just be you.
Wow.
I went, oh, just be me? Okay. Like, you can still play with the voice and do whatever. I went, well, great. He's a young robot, so he's in this thing, and I figured out what the bass voice was going to be and knew I could see, oh, coming up, this is the voice that's going to be here, this is the kind of thing, and sent it in and thought, oh, wow, you never get that. You never, especially as a VO person, and very rarely as an on-camera person, does a casting director go, I see something in you, and I think you'd be great for this. And she had said, like, frankly, if we were in the room doing this, like a normal audition, I would have just given you that adjustment.
Yes.
And since we couldn't, I wanted to make sure that you got the best chance, because I think you'd be great for this.
Amazing.
And so I got to do it again, sent it in. Next thing I found out, hey, you've got a callback over Zoom. I'm like, well, the Zoom callback is such a fascinating experience.
Yes, it is.
And I thought it was just the second round callback. But when I logged into Zoom, it said tuned in network test.
Oh,
on the thing before the screens came up, I went, Oh, right on. And leading up to it, we didn't know, okay, there might be kids actually playing the game. You're not going to do all of the pages. We're going to pick some parts of it. We'll let you know. We don't know if it's going to be all scripted or if you have to improvise. So the day before, I find out, okay, you're doing the intro, you're doing game 3 and game 5, but all in a row. There are no transitions. You can make up commercials if you want. You have to interview the kids and just treat it like the show. I went, okay. And when I got on, while the kids were taking a little break, I got to talk to the network folks, the showrunner, Luke Wall. Love him to death. He's one of my favorite people on Earth now.
Amazing.
He said, what we loved about your tape, and we wanted to give you a note before we started, was your tape was perfect. So could you just do that again, except with kids? But that's it? That's all you want? He goes, yeah. I know that is the craziest note that we could possibly give you, but really, just do what you did before, but do that with kids on it. Went, okay. And that was it. Like, we just talked a little bit about, oh, yeah, I have this background and I worked on this stuff, and just happy to be there. It was just something to do.
Yeah.
And we go on and we did it, and I was joking around with these kids, just talking to kids like they're people.
Yes.
Not infantilizing them.
Right.
Or anything like that. I was talking to them like fully grown people with actual interests of their own.
Yeah.
And they were very sweet. And they'd been playing these games all day, so they knew the answers.
Yeah.
But they also allowed for mistakes. Like, okay, you're going to make a mistake here, or I'm going to answer this here. And I didn't know who was going to do what.
Awesome.
And we did the whole thing, and they let the kids go take a break, and they call me back in the breakout room, and I'm thinking, oh, here's where you get those notes of, okay, we're going to run game 2 now, but can you try it this way?
Yeah.
And when they pulled me in the room, they just went, hey, we wanted to bring you in here just to say that was absolutely perfect. We loved everything that you did. There's this whole dream list of things that we were hoping for out of it. You checked all of those boxes, and then you did all of this other stuff.
Amazing.
And just wanted to let you know we loved everything about it, and we're definitely going to be in touch. And I thought, okay, well, that's great. Thank you. And thanked them for it. And I called my agent and said, hey, it went as well as it could. This is what they said. And you're going to be getting a call from casting one way or the other. And he goes, uh-huh. He once joked. He's like, you think every audition you've ever done has been perfect? But no, I just tried to give you some good news instead of, oh, God, I botched this one. But he gets a call a half hour later, and it was casting asking for my headshot and resume. And then a half hour after that, he gets another call, which was the, can you tell him to get new headshots? Because they don't look like him. They're doing him no favors, and he's way better looking in person. Went, wow. Hey, that's flattering.
That is flattering.
Network. But that was my agent's thing of, I gave you a list of expensive photographers and you never use them. Because they're expensive photographers and I can't afford them.
Right.
But if we get this gig, then I will get them.
Yes.
And then we didn't hear much that the rest of the night. I was like, hey, that's still good. That's something. The next day, we didn't hear anything. And he was expecting, I'm going to get a call one way or the other from business affairs.
Right.
And I didn't want to ask.
Yeah.
Like, look. The news will come when the news comes. I don't mind. I'm hanging out with my rescue pup who I got in November, who I love to death.
Awesome.
Named Bertie Woofster, after Bertie Wooster from P.G. Woodhouse. And then I get this call. It's like 7 o'clock at night. He goes, hey, man. So I was expecting a call from business affairs, and we didn't get one. And I just waited all day. And then I called casting and said, hey, what's the deal? I thought we were going to hear something. And the answer was, oh, yeah, sorry, it's the first week of the year and things are really busy and they didn't want to rush getting contracts out, but it's his gig, he got it.
Oh, man.
And that was the way he told me. I went, oh, hey, that's pretty cool. Did you get a contract? He's like, no, not yet. It's like, well, that's the Chicago in me. A thing isn't a thing until there's actual...
Yep. It ain't real until there's paper.
But it still ain't real until someone put money in my pocket.
That's right. It ain't real until it's on air.
Yeah, like an hour later, he goes, oh, short-form contract is here. Monday, long-form contract comes up. And then after negotiations, they're like, we need to make a deal by Wednesday because we got to go into production in a week. But, oh, rad, okay. So right when things get signed, then I get this, Luke just calls me, goes, okay, you and I got to talk. And we get on a Zoom call, and we're just joking around for an hour. And he goes, okay, now we got to have a meeting with Network and all of my bosses. So I went, okay. He's like, and then we're going to have a meeting with the production team. Like, great. And then Thursday, you're going to say, Thursday, you're going to be on set? I'm like, I am? What? He goes, oh, Thursday's tech day. I'm like, you mean like 2 days from now, Thursday? Like, yeah. All right. Here so then while we're there on Thursday, during the course of running this complicated machine, which has an actual practical robot and animators in another room who are tracked, like my face is being tracked and it's triggering reactions, but they can put costumes and things on it.
Incredible.
So we're all trying to figure out each other's rhythms and what works and what doesn't, what can be on the show, what can't. And somewhere around like two or three o'clock in the afternoon, he comes back and we're joking around. I went, are we working tomorrow? And he just starts laughing, goes, we're doing the first two episodes tomorrow. I went, oh, okay. He says, oh, and by the way, you're going to have to rewrite the show. Because it was written, there's like Camel, who was a horse by committee. It had been written and then rewritten by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
And he went, this show succeeds or fails on you.
On you.
On your humor, your style, your delivery.
Yeah.
So I'd like you to be as involved as you want to be. And all I'm thinking is, hey, the only guarantee we got is the number of episodes they gave us in that first contract.
Yeah.
Who knows what the deal is after that?
That's right.
And I just wanted it to be that good.
Yeah.
And my rule was this, working on it. It's like, as long as the kids are having fun, then I'm doing something right.
Because
I wasn't on the set. I was in a room off the set in a duvetine tent.
Yeah.
Just a camera and a bunch of monitors, and I'm watching multiple feeds and different controllers. And I can't hear anybody around me laughing because that would get picked up on the mic.
Yep.
I am not as close, so the energy in the room I'm not getting.
Yeah.
So all I had to go on was, how are the kids doing?
Boy,
are they saying something in my ear from the control room? And then as a bonus, a show like that, it's a 22-minute on-air, half-hour block.
Yeah.
But it takes an hour to an hour and 15 minutes to shoot because there are so many moving pieces and kids are getting blasted with slime and all sorts of things. You got to clear out their goggles or in case something gets shot in their mouth. So for that entire hour, they've got a crew that's around them. They've got people with headsets
and
a medic and people who will intimidate them. And then they got a robot staring at them. And they're at that tender age of, they know they can suspend disbelief and still believe in something magical.
Yeah.
Or they can be the cynics that they will be once they get to high school very soon.
Right.
And I told the people on the crew, like, anytime you're referring to me and you're on set, if you're going to refer to me or say something to me, do not call me Rama. Only call me Nikki. Because I don't want them for a second to doubt the reality of this.
Yeah.
I have to win them over. Before we start recording, I have to get them laughing and joking around and buying into the ridiculousness of this robot.
Yes.
Because if they start doubting it, then they're not having fun. That's bad TV, first of all. But also, these are kids.
Yeah.
And they should be having a good time.
That's
so
great.
The moment all the safety instructions are done, the stage manager would turn and go, hey, kids, say hello to Nikki. And then they would say hi, and they'd see this cartoon face on this robot.
Yeah.
And they think, oh, there's going to be some canned response. And instead, I've heard all of the things that they've been testing before. So then I just start joking around with each one. I know their names. I know something about them. We start playing, get them laughing. If we need to get their energy up, I do something my sister-in-law would do where she'll just randomly go like, oh, yeah, all right. So I started thinking about that. I was like, well, kids love doing call and response. They love catchphrases.
Yeah.
So I would get them all hyped up.
That's awesome.
Just remind them of safety things. Don't jump up and down because there's slime. You could get hurt. These are things. Telling them, I woke up early and made 30,000 gallons of slime. They're like, 30,000? 30,000. That's how much the average human needs. 30,000 above you, 30,000 below you. Where are you going to shop from? I don't know. And just play around with them so much that once the show started happening and there was business going on, they still were having a good time.
Yeah.
And that all I could think of was, no matter how many episodes we got or we get, who knows if we're getting more.
Yeah.
If those kids were having fun, then the people watching it would probably have fun.
That's the That's the greatest mentality to go into that thing, especially working with kids. I mean, to go like, you're my castmates. Mm-hmm. For this, it's a contest or whatever, it's a game show, but we're castmates. We're an ensemble. And having that bedrock of ensemble work is so valuable to be able to make people feel
to make them part of your ensemble. You are my group mind, you know?
Yeah, and I sincerely want all three of them to win.
Yeah.
If I could, somehow, they would all go home with all of that money. And it might be the corporate rebel in me. I'm like, someone's got deep pockets.
Yeah, someone can
and
pay for this.
$1,000 is a line item to you that's been budgeted before we even started this.
That's right.
But for somebody else, this is a new computer. This might help out the family with a bill. This could go towards a college fund.
Yeah.
This might be some ridiculous hype beast pair of Jordans that some 8-year-old should be wearing. But hey, you might have gotten it.
Yeah.
All I think of is, I'd love to give away this money.
Yeah.
The old Win Ben Stein's money.
That's
game
right.
Show. I was like, I would love to give away Ben Stein's money. He shouldn't have it in the first place.
That's right.
So I just took that approach, and it was the same kind of thing with when the pandemic hit. The day that I closed on this townhouse that I got, because circumstances aligned themselves, and renting in LA is like burning your money in a dumpster.
Yeah.
And it was like, here's a moment. We got to jump on it. And I got it. The day I was signing closing documents, I get a call as I walk into the escrow office from a friend of mine at WME going, hey, I heard something and you got to know.
Oh, no.
And I went, oh, no. This is what I think it is, isn't it? He goes, yeah. Because you could see the writing on the wall. The frequency of the auditions coming in was less. The people sending it to you weren't the people you thought were going to be sending it to you.
Yeah.
It's harder to get a hold of people. So we knew. Things weren't going well since the pandemic. They had the UFC, they had pro bullfighting, they had New York Fashion Week, they had the WGA thing going on. There were so many elements that things were going to change, and a few of us looked around and went, you're not working as much. I'm not working as much. And when we're talking work, we're talking about the auditions.
Yeah.
It's like, did you read for this? Did you read for this? Nobody had that conversation. We were like, well, what's going on? So the day that I'm signing to get a 30-year albatross on my neck was, hey, congratulations, you went from being repped by the biggest agency in the world to nothing. And it was immediate. And this is how I knew I was going to be okay. We were very rational when we talked about it.
Hmm.
And I went, well, that's not fun. And he went, what's your next move? I went, hey, you know, I guess I should cut a new demo together because I've booked a lot of things over the last 10 years. And that old demo, they didn't even use it while I was at WME. They didn't need it because I was there.
Yeah.
But I can't use that anymore.
Right.
And I've booked enough. Yeah, okay. I'll cut a new demo. I'll update the resume and I'll figure it out. And I expected 3-4 months of going back to pounding the pavement and being like, well, I was here.
Yeah.
And I just love this man to death, James Adomian. James Adomian is one of those amazing L.A. comedy fixtures, whether he was at UCB, his stand-up. He's the best Bernie Sanders impressionist on the planet, and that's just one. Like his Sebastian Gorka might be my favorite thing that he's ever done. He and I became friends off of – I did an impression showcase at the PAC Theater for Eric Moneypenny.
Okay.
And Eric, I've worked with him on all those AOK digital shorts, being Caillou the Grown Up and Adult Arthur. And there's entire realms of people who have found me purely because, like, you Caillou? When Caillou? When Caillou come back? Why Caillou bald? Or I want to kill Caillou. Caillou should be dead. It's like, look, I made him as horrible as I could. And they just love the game of it. They want to see how far we would go.
Yeah.
When it was a random thing on Facebook. It was one of those posts. It was in the PAC Theater community group. Eric posted something like, who can do these Muppet baby voices? Or who can do Muppet impressions? So I went, I can do it. I didn't know him. And I was only performing at the PAC with the music improv troupe I was a part of, the Sound of Musical.
Yeah.
And because BOC, Brian O'Connell, had brought us over there because he loved us from I.O. And he brought us over there. He added us to that community thing. And I saw it and went, yeah, okay. But there wasn't anything to read.
Yeah.
You just had to prove to Eric that you could do it. So I recorded a free-form conversation as every one of the Muppets that he had brought up. And there was some party going on across the fence of our complex. And I just started off with Kermit the Frog here. I'm supposed to be telling you some things about me, but there is a party going on and I wasn't invited! And then just started going into each one of the different voices. And he hit me up and went, I want you to be Bunsen Honeydew. Like, oh, good, Beaky. Let's go do some voices. So I went in and recorded the stuff for him, and he just asked, hey, do you have a reel? He's like, what do you want, animation, commercial, or impressions? Like, whatever you got.
Yeah.
And I was very close. I was almost on Dana Carvey's first impressions. Made it to the network test. The week of the shoot, they pulled the hold on me.
Oh, man.
But they can't take away the fact that I made Dana Carvey laugh and Greg Fitzsimmons and Freddie Prinze Jr., and I did Lovitz. I did the Lovitz impression in front of Dana Carvey.
Amazing.
As a bit of, it's a morning zoo radio show, and we're talking to some celebs, and the question was, has anyone had a threesome? And I went, I have. Let me introduce John Lovitz. John Lovitz's left hand and John Lovitz's right hand. And all the bits that we did, he turned to me after we did that, and when the suits were tying, he goes, you know, I know, John. Like, I know.
Yeah,
I know. It was a risk. He goes, you know what he would say if he knew that you did that? I went, what? He goes, so they're doing me now. That is incredible. And he starts telling me stuff about him. He goes, you know, whatever way this goes, when we're done, would you mind if I took a video of you and sent it to John?
Amazing.
I went, yeah, okay. So we do the whole thing, and then he recorded a video of me and just goes, hey, John, I got a present for you. Flips it over to me and goes, hello, John. It's me. Or should I say you, only darker. And then just riffed until I ran out of steam. I go, that's it. He goes,
that's great.
Love you, buddy. And he sent it. And I did Macho Man Randy Savage singing karaoke. You don't know what song you're going to get until they put it up there. And Freddie Prinze Jr., I had spaced at the time, had worked for WWE.
Oh, my God.
He knew Randy Savage. He knew all this stuff. So I was singing Like a Virgin by Madonna as Randy Savage. Going, I made it through the wilderness. Oh, yeah. I made it through. And I never found anything mean, Gene. Until I met you, dig it. And just kept adding his catchphrases. And he turned to me and he goes, you know what's great? You have the voice. The voice is there. The key to doing Randy's voice is you got to breathe on the second syllable. You drive everything on the first. You recover on the second. You pick up on the third. It's like, it's the only way you can sustain that voice for that long.
Wow.
And I paused and thought about it. I went, that is so true.
Yeah.
And the other thing I didn't realize, I did Roger Rabbit at a parole board. Freddie Prinze's dad, Freddie Prinze Jr.'s dad, Freddie Prinze, his godfather, Charlie Fleischer.
Is he
and
really?
I do this thing, yeah. And I do this thing where they say, I'm coming up next on the docket, it's Roger Rabbit. How do you plead? I didn't do it, I tell you. It was the weasels. It was a frame up. They put it there. They put what they told me. I walked through it. Now I'm trapped in here. Don't leave me. I'm too petty. I need Jessica. I just started crying and going, please let me go. It was a mistake. And they thought I was completely, completely nuts. And Freddie turned to me and went, if you think that was crazy, imagine growing up with crazy Uncle Charlie over at your house.
Oh, my God.
And I just really went, wow, I really didn't think this through in a safe way. So
oh,
I did
man.
All of this at the pack. And Eric did the show. He's like, look, it's for a comedian. You can probably guess who it is. But I'm not telling anybody because I don't want to psych anybody out. But you and these other people are the strongest impressionists I know. I want to put you guys at the top. You have 5 minutes. Do whatever you want.
Amazing.
So I did 17 impressions in 4 minutes, and everyone was a joke that was also a setup to the next joke.
Awesome.
And the thing that James loved the most was I did Kumail Nanjiani and their friends, and all I said was, you know, from now on I want to be referred to as one-time Oscar loser Kumail Nanjiani. That way it keeps me humble, but it reminds all of you I'm a one-time Oscar nominee. And that he really bit on because he knows him.
That's awesome.
But that one I had played with so much. And that was an impression that I could tell you took me exactly 30 days, start to finish, to figure out his voice. I listened to a stand-up special, Beta Male, to and from work every day, going, there's got to be some way in. There's
you're looking for that hook. What's
sound? Yeah.
What's,
Dana
what's your...
Carvey brought that up. He he said to us, like, so what impressions is everybody working on? It's like 2015.
Yeah.
He goes, everybody's got a Trump, right? He's like, everybody's got to be working on a Trump. Everybody's got one. So when he said it, he's like, what are you working on? It really hit me. I went, this is a lot of work.
Yes.
Some voices come to you really. I never had to try with Casey Kasem. He was always there.
That's
right. And I could easily make it into Shaggy from Scooby-Doo.
Right.
Some of them have always been there.
Yeah.
But then other ones like Kumail or Rami Malek or
yeah.
Riz Ahmed or whoever.
Yeah.
I find ways in. Like the trick with Riz, you have to sound like you're from East London, then you have to sound like you're from New York, then you have to be able to rap. And I've been doing sound-alikes for all of them for a long,
amazing.
For a couple years now.
That's so great.
But it's there's so much work that goes into
yeah,
it. So
there
when
really
I did
is.
That show for Eric at the Pack, I met James, and he's such a nice guy, and we stayed in touch, and then he asked me to be on The Underculture, his podcast that he had at Forever Dog. And the show that we did, I gave him a list of voices, and he said, I want to do Bill Clinton and Roger Rabbit on their way to Little St. James, which was Epstein's little Lolita island. And it was the first time in that show that it wasn't just a conversation of here's two people in a place. It was a Indiana Jones type adventure story. It started on the seaplane from Tailspin. So he got to do the whole Phil Harris Baloo the Bear voice and as Bill Clinton, and then I was Roger Rabbit, and then we were on a boat, and then we were invading this satanic temple.
Oh, man.
And it had even a cartoonish ending where I made him fall through one of the Acme holes. And for some reason, when I was coming back from finding out, hey, I don't have rep anymore.
Yeah.
I just thought it was such a ridiculous way to find out.
Yeah.
Via email, and it was from the lawyers, so you didn't. It wasn't your agent saying, "Hey, sorry guys."
Yeah.
It happened. It was a lawyer, and all the email addresses for your agents were gone. So it's like, oh well, I had to find a way to get in touch with them because there were enough things I was working on. They went, "Well, what's the deal with this? What's the deal with this? How am
yeah.
I going to get paid for that? Am I still on the hook for this?"
Right.
And I just said to James, "I went, well, in today's fresh hell." They just shut down WME's voiceover department. He went, wait, what? I went, yeah, just Dear John. And he asked, do you have all your stuff? I went, yep, send it to me. I'm going to send it over to my guys at Innovative.
Amazing. Went,
all right. And then I had, because when I got to WME, I didn't tell anybody except for people who needed to know.
Yeah.
I never posted anything from it.
Yeah.
I didn't bother. I was like, look, this is work. I'm here. No one needs to know.
Yeah.
But there was one of those days, a 4-hour day, 5-hour day, where the internet crashed, all the computers went down, and Sean Michael Howard, wonderful guy, decided we need to take a group picture of everybody who's here right now because this is silly.
Wow.
And he's like, this will never happen again. So we got this group photo of everyone who wasn't in the booth, and it was just so nice that we all thought about it, and I saw another friend put it up and went, all right. So I put it up. And just honestly, I was like, look, it's not the way that you want to have this go, but
yeah.
I've no ill will to my agents or anything because
yeah.
I got so much better there
yeah.
for them taking a chance on me. And I learned so much about what I do from the people I was with.
Yeah.
But what I'll miss most is we were this island of misfit toys across the street from Ari Emanuel's office where we got the burnt diner coffee and bags of Bigelow tea if we were lucky. We often didn't have sugar. Honey was hot on hard supply. The computers would break down. You'd play that 2-hour gamble of, can I get the free parking or do I need to move?
Uh-huh.
Everybody would be giving you clues on, hey, don't go this way, don't go that way.
Yeah.
Just ducking out of work and hiding there with some amazing folks.
Yeah.
Like, that is what I'm going to miss,
yeah.
is being there with these people.
Yeah.
And because I put that up, people went, oh, my God, what? How did that happen? How does that happen to a place like that?
Yeah.
But then I got a message from Zara Fuzzle. And Zara is someone who I've never met in person, which
Still,
is shocking.
It is shocking.
We have so many friends, and we've both been around, and two of the people were like, oh, well, you must know each other. And we knew each other as two of the voiceover professionals who happen to be South Asian who identify as, hey, we're Desi or South Asian voice actors.
Yeah.
We're not actors who also do this. This is what we do. This is what we like to do.
Yeah.
And there were a handful of us. So we were following each other on a bunch of things and we would trade messages. And then she said, hey, this is a weird way to slide into your DMs, but what happened? Because she had been there before. And I told her, and I went, yeah, it's just a weird thing. You never expect when the average life of someone rep there who's doing the work is 20 plus years. They're like, great. I never have to pound the pavement again.
Right.
Unless I want to leave for a different situation. And she said, do you have your stuff?
Wow.
I'm going to send it to my people at A3. And I went, okay, great. And I always tell my students, the worst thing that you can be, the one thing you can not afford to be in this town is unprepared.
Yes.
So if you tell somebody that you're a writer, you better have a script for them to read. If
That's
you tell
right.
them you're a director, here's a link to something I did.
Yes.
Or here's a portfolio of my art. Because if you say, well, I'm working on this idea, the moment you have that well or qualifier,
yeah.
you're not serious enough.
That's right.
For anybody who's giving you time. I went, yeah, I'll get it to you right away. And I was in the process of moving out of that apartment by myself in the middle of a pandemic.
Yep.
And I'm high risk as an asthmatic, so I wasn't letting people come. I
yeah.
couldn't afford movers. So I was just packing up boxes and things.
Dude.
And I got this... I sent everything to James. I sent everything to Zara. And just randomly, there wasn't an email follow-up about this. Zach Kaplan from Innovative calls me. And I'm packing boxes. And he goes, hey, so James sent me your stuff this morning. And James never sends anybody's stuff. So that got my attention.
Wow.
Then I read right away that you were one of the WME castaways. And you did all this. And I listened to your stuff. And what are you doing right now? It's like, packing up my apartment and moving. He goes, great, so you have plenty of time to talk. And we were just we just found ourselves joking around for 2 hours.
Oh, so Zach is the greatest guy. I love
yeah,
Zach.
It wasn't about – he wasn't trying to sell me on yeah. anything. He was just very honest, and we were joking about things. And we both could just name check all of these different voice actors where like these are the people I look up to. I told people on a panel I was on recently, I've been chasing Rob Paulsen my whole life.
Yeah.
Like, just thinking, that man has the best job on earth, and it sounds the most fun. How do you do that? How do you get there? And I met him at his book signing. And when I got up to him and handed him the book, I just said, I have no idea what to say to you right now. And he goes, oh, really? Why? I went, you're the reason I do what I do. He goes, get out of town. What's that? I said, I'm a professional voice actor at WME. Right away, his posture changed. He went from, I'm talking to a fan, to all of a sudden, I'm talking to one of us.
He leans
forward. He's like, get out of town, really? And then we just start comparing notes. It's like, I was like, I was almost late for this because I had to do a re-record for DreamWorks for a thing. And I barely got here, but I'm here now. He goes, well, you did the right thing. You definitely do that. Who was the casting director on that? And then we just started talking about casting directors and what we're working on. And I told him, I've been this close to getting that big animated thing, and that's what I've been trying to get my whole life, but I got everything else. That's the one missing piece.
Yeah.
And he goes, how old are you? So it's 32. He goes, ah, you're a baby. You got plenty of time. I said, but you said in your book you were 28 when you got the first thing, so you were ahead. But when I walked in that room, I went by myself to this. He was reading part of the book, and Maurice LaMarche was there moderating this Q&A. And right when I walked in, I just started clocking me. It was like, there's Jess Harnell. There's Tress McNeil. There's Townsend Coleman. There's Bob Bergen. Bob Bergen with his amazing cane that
yes.
has Yosemite Sam and Porky Pig carved in it. And Tom Kenny. I saw Tom Kenny, and I was intimidated right away.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, this guy. And he was just so nice. He was talking to everybody, waving at everybody.
Incredible.
And I just knew. I was like, oh, I probably would say something like, can you not audition for this one so I can just get in? But I would talk to Zach about that stuff, and he just started giggling. He's like, I love that you can nerd out about this stuff. You're like one of 1,000 people who could walk into a room and just go, I know that voice. Like the John DiMaggio phrase. Like, I know that voice.
Yeah.
And I was so excited about it. And when I met him, because of how his posture changed and how his tone changed, as I walked away and I read the thing that he wrote in my book, I went, and he got a video with me too. I went, have I turned a corner? I think I've crossed over. If he's taking me seriously, then I have to take me seriously.
Yeah.
So that's great. I believe him. I believe that it'll be soon. And I believe that I'll be working with him at some point.
Yeah.
And when I talked to Zach about all that, he said, give me 6 months. Give me 6 months and you're going to get that. I promise you. I went, all right. And I talked to all the other agencies and they were all lovely. And really, it just came down to the same reason I went to Syracuse, same reason I've done everything else, is that spirit of, well, why not?
Yeah.
You can find a million excuses not to do something.
Yeah.
But you only need one reason to do anything. And that's, well, why not?
Yeah.
So, because the vibe was right. I was like, well, I'm gonna go with this guy. He's a nut. And I like that. Because he even said to me, he's like, look, take all your meetings. And if you choose to go with us, frankly, I'd be honored because I think you're that good. But if you don't, I'm not going to be mad, but just understand I'm going to be emailing you and I'm going to be shooting you messages just because I think you and I would be friends.
Amazing.
And we should hang out. But also, you are that good, and I want to see you on all these things. I'm like, hey, that's cool. So then a month into me working with him, I booked a guest shot on, which was the first thing that I booked that was a union animated gig. I'd done all of those AOK shorts, and I loved it. Eric gave me so much experience and so much freedom making voices for everything. Nick Ligger, myself, Jillian Dunn, Katie Molinaro, we were the ones who were pretty much on everything. Where you go, well, I know I've got you. There's always a part for you and for Nick. I went, great, because I like coming in here because you give me money to buy records. And so I go, it's like, oh, you're doing this for $50, and then you go down the street, go to Amoeba, and you pick up a record or two.
Right.
It was a great deal. And I got animated footage. I know everybody's got someone who can do similar things to them, or their mind works like they do in what we do.
Yeah.
And for me, that's Alan Tudyk.
Yeah.
Because yeah.
I hear what you're saying.
When I saw Wreck-It Ralph, I was so excited and also biting my lip going, damn, when he popped up as King Candy.
Man.
What he's doing this much and how amazing it was. I'm looking around going, he just took Ed Wynn off the table.
He didn't.
Nobody is going to be able to do Ed Wynn's voice.
No.
Ever again.
He didn't even do a variation. It's a straight impression. And you're
and
like.
It was so good.
And it was so good.
Perfect voice.
Perfect.
And I was like, I can't be mad at this guy. I love everything that he does. And I went, well, okay. I know in my head what some voices are that I would like to bring to the party.
Yeah.
That I will keep secret so
yes.
that he doesn't think. I don't want to put it out there so that he might latch onto it somewhere.
Yep.
He's one. Some people who've seen Tuned In, they'll send me messages saying that you sound like that guy on DuckTales. And they mean Ben Schwartz.
Uh-huh.
Which we do go up for a lot of the same parts, and he gets them. But he's also great. You never know. It's like, what's your favorite gig? Hopefully it's the next one.
Yes.
But I've just been enjoying it, and I'm at this wonderful place of zen where I knew I would be okay.
Oh,
I was like,
man.
I'm going to be okay. So then when WME said, oh, we're done, I went, oh, that's fine.
Yeah.
It's okay. Like, I've been there. I got the most out of the alphabet soup, three letters that you're going to get.
That's right.
This at least gets me a conversation somewhere else. Question is, where do I want to be?
Yeah.
Where's best for me?
Yeah.
And I was able to make a decision and not just chase a situation going, well, I know what it's like to play at the biggest, and it's the same across different agencies, just different agents.
Yeah.
The engineers are always great. The agents are great. The assistants are great. You can be kind with any of them.
Yeah.
Which situation is best for me now?
Yeah.
And there was just something about that. Crazy Zach Kaplan.
You gotta
love him.
That's so fantastic. Jack's a terrific guy. I was with Innovative briefly when I got to town and always enjoyed my interactions with Zach. He's such a sweet man and very funny and yeah, man, just
the
best.
Do you know, there's no way you would remember this. Do you know the first time I saw you, the first time I ran into you?
No.
This must have been 2013, 2014 at Second City. I was working with Dan Wessels, who's
another
really good friend of ours.
Amazing music director.
I think I was in his music improv class, and I got there early because I was coming from work. And as I'm coming up the stairs at Second City, those riggedy stairs, all I hear is, there's a calm surrender to the rush I know. Like, who is singing? And I walk in the room, and you're standing there rehearsing Elton John's album version of Can You Feel the Love Tonight? And Dan's playing along, and every time you go, and can you feel the love tonight? He would go, tonight. I just went, what is happening here? And when you left the room, I went, what were you doing, Dan? He goes, oh, do you know Kiff? You should totally know Kiff. You guys do the same stuff. But that's Kiff? And I'd heard about you. It's like, wait, he's the guy who teaches the VO class. He's at CSD. He's been in all these video games.
Yeah.
That's Kiff?
Yeah.
So it's the best way for me to be introduced to you was you singing Elton John.
That's amazing.
And then running into you at Kevin and Natalie's wedding. I still, the booming the booming timbre of your voice going, and thus the binding is made.
Oh,
pops
man.
Into my head randomly when people are making decisions and you see like some basketball players signing a contract. You go, and thus the binding is made.
And thus the binding is made.
There's
oh,
just these
man.
Amazing ones. Like, wow, there's all of this, and I listen to your podcast, and then all of a sudden,
here we are.
Circumstances threw us together.
That's right. Oh, man, I couldn't be more grateful for you spending the time tonight and sharing, like, so much of your story, your not only your voiceover journey, but your improvisation journey, the highs and the lows, and, like, I mean, you're such a fascinating and hilarious and talented cat, and, like, to, you know, what you've really outlined, and I've done a fair amount of coaching lately with folks, and, you know, the question that always comes up, and I mentioned this earlier, is like, well, how do I get to that next step? And what you've outlined really beautifully is it's a 7-year step. Mm-hmm. It is a tremendous amount of work and patience and endurance, and you can't measure yourself by anybody else's measuring stick. It's what your professor said to you back at Syracuse. It's be in that moment, be here now, mm-hmm. be present, be the needle on the record at that moment in the vinyl, and address what faces you then, not what might be, you know, 5 grooves over or on the other side of the album.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you've got to follow this song all the way to the end. Mm-hmm. To find out what's next. And it might not be representation. It might not mm-hmm. be, union gig. It might suck. You might have to, you know, in my case, you might have to donate a kidney and get divorced before you can get the things that you want in life. But
right.
those things are the things that make you who you are when you walk into that, when WME offers you that job, offers you that interview. It is those mountains and valleys that you have to go through so that you can be ready to meet that with the person that you are at that time.
And I know the conversation that we had meandered a bit, and I lost the track of the question, but that's kind of how this goes, where you have a plan, you have an idea of this is how I need to get to wherever. But then a beautiful thing happens, a beautiful and terrifying thing happens, and that's called life. And you have to actually pay attention to what's going on around you and with you, with your friends, with your family, and you cannot make your life about your work. One of the things laid bare by this pandemic is the fallacy of the American working system, the capitalist structure in general, of the idea of most meetings don't need to be meetings.
Yes.
You don't need to be in an office. There are things that, like, I've been baking bread for years because I wanted to control what it was that I was eating.
Yes.
And didn't need that many preservatives. Plus, it's a meditative thing. I just really love cooking and baking.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things I don't let people commodify for me. It's like, I let people tell me what cartoons to draw, and it made me so depressed I stopped drawing for a year.
Wow.
And then I stopped telling people because it became a social currency at the Second City, and I didn't know.
Yeah.
Like, oh, if I drew a cartoon of somebody, they went, oh, I've arrived. I'm part of that group now.
Wow.
But no, it's just I get bored at work, and I draw friends of mine because they make me happy.
Yeah.
But then I started getting, can you draw this person? Can you draw this person? And it was to win points if they were dating or some situation. I went, this is not fun for me anymore. You've taken all the joy out.
Yeah.
Or people asking, well, why don't you sell bread? Like, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
I do this because it's nice, and I like giving this to people. It also created that impression that I'm always eating bread. It's like, no, I make them, and then I mostly give everything away.
Yeah.
They went, what? It's like, all these cookies and cakes and things. I don't really want them. What do you mean? It's like, I want to know that I can do it.
Yeah.
But I prefer the savory to the sweet, so I'll make these things and give them away. Right. My friends both love and hate it because now there's an endless supply of things. But I've learned more from the things I didn't get, from the gigs that passed me by, from every opportunity that I thought was going to be the one that ultimately wasn't.
Yes.
That, and I've had a lot of loss in my life of family members or friends and people who have just been taken too soon. and life is random. It is hard to explain. It's not always going to be good, and you can't pretend that it is, which once I busted my knee, I really got to stare that in the face and then be forced to really deal with 30 years worth of avoiding things.
Yeah.
To the things that you will regret are not the gigs you didn't get or the shows you didn't do. It's not saying the things to the people in your life who matter when you have the chance.
Amen.
Because once you don't anymore, the only thing you ever want is just a little more time. And that's the one thing that you can never get. And it's terrible because, especially in the community I come from, this South Asian community or broadly Asian community, this is not things that we don't talk about this.
Hmm.
Your feelings, your emotions, things like that aren't exactly a priority. It's not about you. It's about the group. It's about the family, the extended family. It's about the community. Don't make it about yourself.
Hmm.
And there's just a lack of language for a lot of us for expressing feelings that aren't related to career or goalpost things in life of, oh, I've done this, now I got to do this, or expectations. And all credit to my family for forcing me to actually address all of that, and people like Richard Dubin in my life who handed me Be Here Now and talked to me about Joe Venuti and Stuff Smith, or John Lynn, preeminent military historian, who to this day I send him emails and I buy his books and just check in with him, and he will always say, well, whenever you're done playing and you want to go back and do the real work, you let me know. There's these relationships that you maintain.
Yeah.
There are relationships that clarify themselves, and there's nothing wrong with knowing it. There's nothing wrong with knowing that your relationship is purely utilitarian or that there is a professional transaction involved in it. If you're aware of it, and you don't need to know everything that's going on in everybody's life, and everyone shouldn't know everything that's going on in yours.
Right.
But to recognize that doesn't mean that you're not a kind person. It doesn't mean that you're not rooting for those people or that you want the best for them. You just know that when the chips are down, you're not the person they're calling and they're not the person you're calling.
Yeah.
And just really starting to appreciate everything that can be going on, like walking down the street and the wind in the leaves, or the simplicity of you can go to a grocery store and buy one thing and not be terrified and wearing triple masks and double masks. There's these moments that you want and that you really want to hold on to. And it reminded me of something I heard on Rob Paulsen's Talking Tunes podcast with when he was talking to Jim Cummings.
Uh-huh.
And they said, a terrible impression is just another character. It's like, that is brilliant. And if you extrapolate that further, it's like a really bad moment in your life or a humiliating moment in your life just makes for a great story later on. Because I went from a guy with a double bachelor's and honors and a master's from Newhouse to 8 months later, I was hanging out of the back of a cube truck in the Mojave Desert with one hand on the oh shit bar, hoping that the guy who was driving wasn't going to crash us at 4:30 in the morning as the sun rose, where it was 120 just 6 hours earlier. Now it's 28 degrees.
Man.
And I looked out and went, this is my life now. I'm picking up exploded car parts in the desert. Or I got fired via text message from an office gig that I was working while working for the UFC because the office manager went on vacation, came back 2 weeks later, and no one noticed he was gone because I did his job.
Oh, my God.
Like, just these weird things. I go, this is funny, because then I ran into him while I was directing something at Blizzard, and there he was. And I didn't even say anything to him, and then he stopped me in a stairwell. He went, so are you PAing? I was like, no, I'm directing. He goes, what? Oh, I always knew something good was going to happen. But sure you did. Sure you did. But yeah, all of those, I look back and go, well, the biggest reason I can't look back at the pictures from 23 to 30 is I can see all of the stress that I allowed to take over my life on my face. Where it's like, okay, you're grinning because you're having a good time, but every other part of you, the body language, from the dress, just the look, I'm like, there was just so much stress and sadness and pain and whiskey and mistakes that were being made. They went, well, I'm notoriously calm now. And people say that a lot. Like I make them calm. I said, well, because I've lived enough and I've lost enough that I know what's important and what isn't. And I know that the little things that drive people nuts are the things that you allow yourself to drive you nuts. Like traffic in LA doesn't bother me as much as it should, because I always go in knowing, hey, here's this really cool album I'm going to listen to.
Yeah.
Or I have time for this podcast.
Yeah. The traffic gives me time. It gives me time.
And my brother really put it in perspective for me, because he was driving back from work and I went to visit and he didn't have the radio on. And I asked him why. He went, because for these 15 minutes, I have quiet. It's like, no one's looking for me. Nobody's asking for anything. There isn't a baby crying. My wife isn't looking for something. For these 15 minutes, it's just me and the road.
Oh, man.
And I thought about it. I was like, wow, now I'm really cognizant of all of these different things. Sometimes you just need it off. Sometimes you need to drive with the windows down.
Oh, man.
And it wouldn't, had I not had all of those rough things, I wouldn't appreciate any of where I am now in the way that I do.
Yeah.
Where other actor friends of mine one joke today, like, I don't know how you are so calm with callbacks and things like that. Well, what is it they say? The gig is the audition. You hope for the callback. The callback's your job. Anything after that is a bonus. Yeah. So here's something I get to do, and then if not this one, hey, there's something else.
Yeah.
There might be something else. And as my really great friend, basically sister, sometime writing partner, Rashida Sheeds Olaiwola says, what's for you ain't gonna miss you. So no, don't get hung up on the things that you don't get, because there's something else coming along.
That's
so
both great.
Just remind each other that. We're like, okay, you can be upset for like 5 minutes about the thing that you didn't get, but
if it's
something else is coming.
If it's for you, you'll get it. And if it's not,
it'll be much
better.
That's
so great.
So anyone listening who's wondering how they're going to get to wherever they ultimately want to be with voiceover or any other profession, it's be open to all the possibilities. Never be afraid to take a class.
Yeah.
And prioritize living.
Yeah.
Your best characters are going to come from listening to people, just hearing conversation on the street. My brother calls it sponging, and it drives him nuts, where you can tell that I'm not paying attention to what's going on because I'm listening to two people talking, which he caught me on a tram at DFW. He's like, stop it. I'm like, what? He's like, you're sponging. He's like, you could tell me that whole conversation. I'm like, I can. Look, we did everything we had to do. We got here on time. We got our bags. We're on the tram. Like, we're 2 hours early. Flight's either going to take off or it isn't.
That's right.
We can't fly. We did what we had to do. Hey, they put us up for a night. Hey, not a problem for me. We got to stack.
Oh, my
and
God.
All
dude.
All those things matter. They all matter. Yeah. And it costs nothing to be kind. So
Dude. Do
all of those things and you'll be much, much calmer. And take time to disconnect. Get off of the social media. Put the phone away.
Yeah.
If you can, one of my favorite things I ever did was one day I just wandered into a park, laid on the grass, stared at the clouds while listening to Kamasi Washington and reading one of those old 10-cent copies of Ian Fleming's Thunderball.
Yes.
That my grandfather had.
Oh,
amazing.
Laying
there on the grass, listening to jazz, reading this book, staring at the clouds.
Amazing.
And it's like moments like that, or in Paris, my favorite place was always the Tuileries Gardens.
Uh-huh.
For that same reason. It's at that perfect elevation that the clouds are so close that you can feel like you can reach out and grab them. But also there's people playing music, there's people selling crepes, there's gendarmes staring at people, there are kids boat races. but you're just laying on the grass and staring at the clouds. And that stuff is the stuff that'll miss you if you're just focused on the money. You'll always, the last thing is, as Richard Dubin, the professor from Syracuse, reminded me, you'll always find a way to make money. But you won't, you'll always find a way to make money, but you won't always find a way to be happy. So don't worry about the money. The money will sort itself out.
Yes, it will.
Chase your happiness, find your bliss.
Dude.
Whatever it is, from eating a really good muffin to listening to a record, just enjoy those small things, because the small things are the biggest things in the end.
Dude, I could talk to you for another 3 hours, but unfortunately, I don't know,
oh,
if,
wow.
I don't know if a hard drive space. This has been such a delight, dude. It's been so terrific to get to know you. How can people find you on social media if they want to reach out to you and connect to you? And where are you at, and how can people find you?
If they do, I am on Twitter and Instagram under my name, just at Rama Valuri. Facebook, I don't really go on much, so you'd be fighting a losing battle.
I hear you.
If you went there. That's the best, or just go to Google and type my name in.
Terrific.
Eventually you'll find out what I'm up to. but that is it. Otherwise, you can probably find me listening to this podcast.
Excellent. Well, that's where we find everybody who's joining us right now, is listening to this podcast. And I'm so grateful that you took this journey with us. Dude, thanks again so much for taking the time tonight. This was really, really terrific.
Thank you for having me, and good luck cutting this down to 45 minutes.
Yeah, thanks. That's not going to happen. I think I'm going to pull the soundtrack show style thing and break this into two or three episodes. And
Well, anytime you need anything, you let me know. It was an absolute pleasure, and thank you for being you. From singing "Can You Feel the Love Tonight" to hosting this podcast, I will always be a fan of Kip Van and Hubel.
Well, thank you, Rama. I am truly a fan of yours, and I look forward to sharing a room with you as we voicing a cartoon together someday.
Oh, yeah. As Jamie Moyer
future.
Would say, I'll see you at the session.
And we will see you at the session next time on All Over VoiceOver. Thanks for listening. I'm Kif. This was Rama Valuri, and well, it still is Rama Valuri. He's
I'm still here, but you're closing the show.
But so. I'm closing the show, so I'm going to close it. So take care. Peace. This has been All Over VoiceOver with Kif VH. Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please go to iTunes and give us a positive rating. It truly helps. Follow me on Twitter at Kif VH, or on Instagram at Kif VH, or on Vero at Kif VH. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you soon. Claim victory and depart the field.
Werewolf?
There.